So my talk today is GNU Linux around the world. And I'll give you a warning, a lot of this talk is tongue-in-cheek. Most of these things I'm talking about, in fact, all of them I'll be talking about, I actually have pictures, so I must have been there. I may not remember having been there, but I must have been there. And as I said, Moose would not let me do it drunk, so you have to deal with me sober. First of all, I have to remind people that Linux is a trademark of Linus Torvalds in several countries around the world. Linus would like anybody to use the word Linux for any legitimate purpose. So if you'd like to have a Linux brand of clothes, or a Linux brand of cars, or a Linux brand of food, perfectly capable of doing that, all we ask is that you register it with the Linux Mark Institute. Registration is free, of course. And that helps us to protect the Linux trademark. And Unix is the trademark of XOpen in several countries around the world. Unix is used as a brand. It is used to define a set of interfaces. And consequently, it shows that you can make a Unix system without using any of SCO's code, no matter what they say. Okay, so the topics of discussion for tonight is Linux as an international project, and the importance of this concept. Why is it important? But I'm going to step way back in history for a moment. That I was over in the Far East, and I actually saw a plaque which mentioned the first use of Unix firewalls, which is in Istanbul in 1453 AD. Now, you've heard of the black hats and stuff. Well, they had black eunuchs and white eunuchs there guarding the harems, okay? And they did spell it slightly differently. But this brings up an important point, because I want to point out that open source is not new, okay? It's been around for a very long period of time. In fact, when I started off in computers, most programs were delivered in open source. When you ordered a compiler, even a commercial compiler, it came on this magnetic tape, and it came with an engineer. And the engineer would spend some time at your facility getting that compiler to run on your computer system and to pass a series of tests to show that it ran. And that was because most of the computers in the world were made in such small quantities that it didn't make sense to try and generate a binary-only shrink-wrap type of market. And there were no computer stores. Because if there had been a computer store, you would need an 18-wheel tractor-trailer truck to haul your computer home. You'd need a three-phase power for your computer, and you need a 20-ton air conditioner to keep it cool. So it was only when economies of scale with things like the Apple II, the IBM PC, maybe a few of the other early manufactured PCs-style computers made shrink wrap something that could happen. Now, over the past couple of years, another amazing thing has happened. We're starting to see a huge number of very, very inexpensive computers. I mean, today you can go out and buy a very nice, very powerful computer for less than $400 on a desktop. Even laptops are in the same category for a decent laptop. And I feel that this new market, where it's not just people in the United States and Western Europe, but it's people in the mountains of Latin America, China, Asia, that are driving open source to be a necessity. And that's because they need to have a bug fix today. Not tomorrow, not on Bug Fix Tuesday or whatever, Patch Wednesday or whatever the vendors call it. And they need to have enhancements, and they need to have them in their own economic environment. I'll explain more about that later. And finally, we need open source because we need to be able to make business decisions about what we're doing. I was talking with Kirk McHughes, and Kirk's my roommate at this. Kirk is the guy who was one of the project leaders of BSD, the real BSD, way back when. And he went upstairs, and I said, Kirk, when was the last time you ever bought a package of software and you put it up on the wall and you put like lights shining on it, candles to either side, like a kind of a shrine or something, right? You don't do that because you're buying the software and the computer to help you solve a problem. Now, that problem may be playing a game. That's a problem, too. You want to have a fast computer to help you solve play that game quickly. But the only real function of the computer is to help you solve a problem. And if you don't have control over the software and the hardware of that computer, then you don't have control over your problem. Now, in 1969, I know you're going to find this hard to believe. In 1969, I was a young college student. And I was starting off to be an electrical engineer, almost got electrocuted by 13,600 volts and 800 amps. Let me tell you something, that's something you remember. And at the same time, I was a co-op student, and I found out that these wonderful things called computers were the most dangerous thing that could happen to you was a paper cut, okay? But as a college student, I didn't have any money for software because, hey, that compiler I told you about with the engineer that comes with it, that cost you $100,000. I just didn't have $100,000 for that. So I joined this organization called DECUS, the Digital Equipment Corporation User Society, and IBM had Share, and Novell had BrainShare or something like that. And they had software that people had written and contributed to the libraries, and for just a small amount of money, you could get that software and use it on your computer. But that was still a lot of money for me, so what I did was I went and got new paper tape from the store, the school store, and I made copies of that software, and I sold it to my roommates for $1 a copy. So I was in the service business of copying that software, testing the software, seeing what its value was, and making those copies for my roommates. Now, also in 1969 in New Jersey, there was a couple of people who decided they wanted to create an operating system for fun. It was a research project. Their names were Ken Thompson and Ben Switchy, and a bunch of others eventually. That started up. And the ARPANET also started in 1969. For those of you that are not familiar with the ARPANET, it eventually morphed into something called the Internet, which most people call the World Wide Web today, but that's a subset, really. And finally, in 1969, well, two more things. It was the last time I ever shaved. And in Helsinki, Finland, little recognized by anybody except two loving parents, Linus Torvalds was born. We'll see more about him later. By 1984, this normal open source distribution of software started to be moving towards a binary-only distribution. Unix vendors started up, Sun Microsystems, Digital Equipment Corporation, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, and they started creating a binary-only distribution. Not only because they wanted to protect their intellectual property, but because of the licensing of AT&T that said if you distributed the source, if you distributed the operating system and source code, you had to pay $160,000 per CPU. That's a fair amount of money. But if you distributed it in binary, you only owed them about $350 royalty on a server class machine. So these companies started to produce binary-only software, and of course you also had other companies like Microsoft producing MS-DOS, CPM was distributed in binary-only form. People started to get away from this open-source type of distribution. But there was this one guy, stubborn person down at MIT by the name of Richard Stallman, who loved to see the source code for operating systems, and so he started a project called GNU, which stands for GNU is not Unix. And then later on, he developed a licensing board called the GPL, General Public License, and eventually formed a foundation called the Free Software Foundation to pull all this together. And he started with this one software, piece of software called Emacs, which is a text editor. Now, how many of you use Emacs? Just out of curiosity, how many of you use VI? Smart people. And it could be said that Richard could have stopped with Emacs because Emacs is kind of like an entire operating system. I mean, I'm suspicious of any text editor that can play its own tower of annoyance problem, okay? But he continued on. Now, he was very smart by doing it this way because he made software that ran across different operating systems. So people said, hey, I'm going to use Emacs on VMS, I'm going to use Emacs on Unix, I'm going to use Emacs on all these other things. If he had started by writing the kernel, he would have ended up with a very uninteresting kernel back in those days with nothing to run on top of it. So he did a very smart thing. And after Emacs, he went into things like, you know, the compiler suite and then eventually the utilities and stuff like that. And so by 1991, almost everything was there. And then it's not only through the Free Software Foundation, but also projects like BSD and other projects like MIT and SendMail and stuff like that. Whole series of different pieces of software came together, this massive group of software that was available in source code form. So by 1991, there was only the kernel that was missing. Now the BSDs were also already there, but they were kind of involved with this whole really nasty AT&T versus BFDI suit that was going on, that was just about coming to a close at that point. When you had these two paths going of the different BSDs and Linux to start up. I'm not going to go into the which is the better operating system because I think that it's in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, but that was where we are at that point. So when you start talking about freedom, however, you have to talk about not free as in beer. Ah, free beer! Okay, no. You have to talk about the freedom you get to use the software for any purpose whatsoever. That's very important because we're going to see a little bit later where Linux got a lot of its start in different areas. Some people say, oh, I'm not so hot about that. But it's also the freedom to read the sources, to change the sources, and to redistribute those changes to people who need them. So this, almost by its nature, makes a lot of the software available at a very low cost or free, and it allows you to make money based on those pieces of software. The only thing is that once you've sold the software, you have to make the sources available to the people. And as a customer, because the software is so low in cost, it allows you to redistribute that money to tailoring the software to meet your own needs. But in the end, nothing is completely free of cost, not even a mother's love.
If you love me, you'll take out the garbage. If you love me, you'll feed my pet, you know.
Everything has a price. But you go down to some place like Brazil, I go down there all the time, I love the Brazilian people in Latin America, and they say, Mad Dog, all of our software is free. Because they pirate about 84% of their PC-based software in Brazil. In Vietnam, they pirate 96%. Wow. Why so high? Well, the average Vietnamese person makes about $4 a day. On $4 a day, they can feed their family, you know, not well and everything, but they can get by. And yet you say to them, and if they need a computer, they can typically dig one out of the garbage, you know, an old 486, a low-end Pentium or something like that. And you say to them, in order to really sell stuff, in order to really be in business, you really need to have a computer. So you got all this, it's cool. But then they go to get the software. And Microsoft Office over in Vietnam is priced at $400. So think about that. That's 100 days that they have to go without eating, without getting clothes, without a shelter, without going out with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, which of course is the most important thing, without beer, okay. That's pretty bad. And if I was in that situation, I'd put a big black patch over my eye and go, RRRB. China used to be 96%, like Vietnam, but the World Trade Organization got after them, and now they're down to only 84% piracy. Now, I know that Richard Stallman doesn't like me saying the word piracy. He doesn't believe that such a thing as intellectual property. That's just a little bit of where Richard and I part company. I do believe there's such a thing as intellectual property, and I believe a person who has a thought, who creates something themselves, should have the right to say what happens to it. I happen to believe that freely licensing something is a good business model, and I encourage people to do that. But on the other hand, I don't spit on them because they don't. Just like I don't spit on people who use Apple products. And I find out that most people do not understand the word freedom. That's a problem, okay? And even in our country, the greatest, freest country of the world, a lot of people don't understand freedom. And so help me, I think they understand it less and less day by day. So now I talk about slavery instead because people have a pretty good idea of what slavery is or was. Because slavery is when you were owned. And when you were owned, you were told when to marry, when to have children, where to go. You were told that you can't have anything that you own yourself because that belongs to the master. And when you were a software slave, you're told how many people can use your computer, when you're going to get your upgrades, where you can put it on, when you're going to have it retired. April of next year. I'm just waiting for it to happen. All those XP people having to go to Windows 8. It's going to be wonderful to see. But that's being a software slave. And if there's one thing that business people in particular don't like, is they don't like being slaves. They don't like losing control. Because that's what happens when you're a slave. You've lost control of your life. And most people don't like that. So, it was in May of 1994. I was working for Digital Equipment Corporation. And I was told that there was this young person who had this really great project. And they should bring him to DECUS in New Orleans to talk about it. Now, how many of you have ever been to New Orleans? How many of you haven't been to New Orleans? New Orleans is the adult Disneyland, right next to Las Vegas, probably even better. You can get anything you want in New Orleans and a lot of things you don't want. And it's one of my favorite places to have DECUS. So, but I didn't know who this person was, I didn't know what they've done, didn't know anything about the software project, but a friend of mine named Kirk Riesler said, hey, we got to do this, so I got $5,000 for my management to bring this person over from Europe. And Kirk asked me to do something which was just unforgivable. He asked me to get a PC to run this software on. Now, anybody knows that PCs are made with those weak, crappy Intel chips. And that digital made real computers using MIPS chips, fax chips, and now Alpha chips. And why Kurt would ever want a weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC to run anything was beyond me. But I got him one. So I flew down there, and there's Kurt trying to install that software onto this weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC. But along came this nice young man with sandy brown hair, wire-rimmed glasses, wearing wool socks with sandals on, and says, may I help you? And Kirk kind of looked at him and smiled and says, yeah, I think you can. And about 10 minutes later, Linux was running on that weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC. That was the first time Linus had ever installed Linux off of a CD-ROM, because his system at home didn't have a CD-ROM. The way he installed Linux was he built the image on a second disk drive, then booted that disk drive to install it on the first one. And they invited me to sit down and use this thing on this weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC, and I did. Now, I collect player pianos. Player pianos, player reed organs, stuff like that. And I can tell you that when you play a piano, if the piano is tuned, you can usually get some pretty good sound out of it. But if you're playing a really fine piano, like a Steinway or Yamaha or something like that, and all the keys are weighted and all the key tops are exactly even, and it's just a joy to play that instrument. And this is what this was like on that weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC. So I started to think about this because Digital had just come out with its Alpha processor, and what I really wanted was something that we could take the Alpha processor and say to universities, hey, why don't you use this to do research on 64-bit address spaces to how to better use algorithms that can run on that and how to improve compilers to be able to handle RISC systems better. Because with 32 bits, you can store 4 billion bytes. But with 64 bits, you can store 4 billion times 4 billion. And that's such a large number that with 4 billion times 4 billion, you can store a gigabyte of data for every second of the day, every day of the year, for the next 5,386 years. Or you can store 128 bytes of data for every square millimeter on the surface of the Earth, including all the oceans. It's a lot of data. So I decided to take Linus out on the Natchez, which is the last real steamboat that goes up and down the Mississippi River. Unbeknownst to me, Linus loves steam engines. And I took him out there, we showed him the steam engine, we had dinner, and we went out to the front of the Natchez, the bow of the Natchez, and we were drinking hurricanes. Yeah. Hurricanes is such a strong drink, after you've had a couple, you feel like you've been hit by Katrina. And was going down the river, and I turned to him and said, Linus, have you ever thought about porting Linux to the Alpha? He says, yeah, I've been trying to do that, but they've been having problems. Gave me an Alpha system in Helsinki, so I may have to do the PowerPC instead. Ah! And I dropped my hurricane. And I never drop a drink, ever. I said, don't do anything rash. And I went back to my office the next day, and I started to do something. Now, people will tell you that the way you get projects done in large companies is you write a proposal, you give it to your management, the management passes it up the line, they look at it, they think about it, they see how it fits in the corporate strategy and all that type of stuff. That's not how you do it. You pull in favors. And I'd worked for Digital Equipment Corporation for 16 years at that point, and there was a lot of people who owed me favors. And I reached out and I said, Jim Jackson, I need an Alpha system sent to Helsinki, Finland right away, and I don't have the time to tell you what it's for, who it's for, or why it's important. I just need it now. He says, well, I just so happen to have an Alpha system underneath my desk, brought back from a customer site. Remember, this is 1994. Memory wasn't $10 a gigabyte or less at that point. It had a 21-inch monitor with a Diamond 3D card in it. It had 96 megabytes of main memory with a 4 gigabyte hard drive and a CD-ROM reader, 2x speed. It had a 4 millimeter tape drive with it. That was $6,000 by itself. And it had a keyboard, mouse, and a very nice system. Its cost was list price about $30,000. And I says, that sounds fine. He says, what are you going to pay for? I says, I'll pay for the shipping. And the next day, it was headed to Helsinki, Finland. So we started the Alpha Linux project, and it was a great project, and I started to understand about community. And actually, when you think about it, Linux is the only major operating system in use today that was started outside of the United States. You know, there's lots of operating systems that work on by people all over the world, including BSD. But Linux was started by this guy from Helsinki, Finland. And that's why when you go through and you ask people, you ask Germans, this, you know, who does Linux belong to? They feel that Linux belongs to them. And of course, the French, they believe everything belongs to them. But they're all correct. Linux belongs to everybody. And so does open source. So right after that, I decided I was going to go to Russia. The Soviet Union had fallen, and Russia was going to have their first Unix Expo. And right before I left Digital, I got this email from Russia. It said, "Comrade, come to Moscow and talk to us about VAXes. We have VAXes here too. The difference between our VAXes and your VAXes is that your VAXes stay up and our VAXes crash." I thought that was kind of funny. And then the second message was even more interesting. "Comrade, come to Moscow and talk to us about Linux, because Linux is free and anything that is free is good." And I wasn't quite really into the free software movement at that point. I just met Linus. And I looked at this and said, "Oh, this poor Russians. They've gotten this word free. They think of free as in no cost versus free as in freedom. And they think that that is what we're talking about." And what I didn't know was they had it 100%. They had it down cold. And I was the one who was mistaken. So, after I left there, and we finished with the Alpha Linux port, it only took 9 months, 9 months, for a dispersed group of people to port a 32-bit system that was running on Intel to a 64-bit system running on Alpha. And that was when the project was actually started on January the 1st of 1995. Linus was finishing up a previous version of Linux before then and studying the documentation. And by November of 1995, Red Hat had a distribution of Linux. So I had these CDs made up. There was actually Intel Linux CDs of the same version as the Alpha. And this is a joint project between Red Hat and Digital. We had about 4,000 of them printed up. And I started going around, handing these things out like Johnny Linux seed. And I would say to people, "Try this out, and if you like this, then try it on the Alpha, because it'd be a lot faster, you have a lot bigger address space." And it was great, and I was handing them out and everything. I went down to Australia, handing them out down there. On my way back, I had one left. And I stopped off in Fiji. Oh, Fiji is a wonderful place. And in Fiji, they have the University of the Pacific. All the professors dress in sarongs, go barefoot, stuff like that. It's right by the ocean. You hear the ocean waves and everything. And they had heard of Linux. But the problem was the entire island was connected to the internet by one 1200 bit per second modem. And they'd be halfway through pulling down the kernel when there'd be some storm in the South Pacific, the line would drop, they'd have to start all over again. So I handed them this CD filled with Linux software, nowhere near as much as you get on distribution today, of course. But when I started to hand it to them, I had this thing go through my head. How much intellectual property am I giving them? How much is this worth? Digital spent $1 billion a year engineering Unix. IBM spent $1 billion a year engineering Hewlett-Packard. Sun Microsystems probably spent $2 billion a year engineering Unix. And I was just handing them this CD. And I felt just like this. And then I left Fiji and went back to the United States. So I went, actually, slightly, I think, after I left Russia too, I went to Dekus in Tel Aviv. I kept going to all these Dekus events. And I went to the room, and I was, you know, giving a talk about, just starting my talk about Linux. And all of a sudden, there was this power failure. Now, they still talk about this power failure today in Israel, because what happened was there was a cascading effect, and every single power station in all of Israel was knocked offline at one time. If the Palestinians had chosen then to attack, Israel would have been gone. But in the room was all of these people from the military, and they were all very interested in Linux. And why are you interested in this? Well, apparently there was this war game that the military had that they deployed, and the war game was typically using about 32 Spark stations and one VMS server. And by using Linux, they were able to reduce the cost of deployment of the war game to one third of what it had been. So there's no religion here. There's no, you know, strictly monetary considerations. Now, talking about free software in government, would you trust your weapons? I mean, we live in a very strange environment. We live in the United States. Naturally, we would trust Microsoft and Apple with their software because they are loyal U.S. citizens. And naturally, we would expect that they would put their code in and there would be no trapdoors in there of any type or any spyware of any type or anything like that. We would just put it in to our chips and our planes and stuff. But if you're a military leader from China, you may have a problem with that, you know, just putting it in, okay? So, flask. And if you're in a government, you have to ask yourself, what would happen if you, with your email system? Now, believe it or not, I wrote that bullet about 12 years ago. Had nothing to do with current state of affairs of NSA or anything like that. That bullet has been there for 12 years. So I said, would you trust your email system to a country? I mean, even as a country as forthright as the United States? And it's not just a war or anything like that, but companies do go bankrupt. You know, we can no longer run our country off of slide rules and hand calculators and books of tables like I used when I was back in college. There are companies like Nortel. How many people remember Nortel? Yeah. Second largest telephone company in the world. And from the time that they started to get into trouble, the bankruptcy was what, a year? Okay, hardly blinking time in business. Or Digital Equipment Corporation, right? I mean, Digital was sold to Compaq, and Compaq was sold to Hewlett Packard. And people say, hey, it still kind of exists. But along the way, there was lots of product lines that were just flushed down the tubes. And it was probably the mail system that you were using in your company, or the data backup system that you were depending on to get your data in and out, or, you know, the graphics system that you built your whole product around. Those are the things that were flushed, and you had nothing to say about it. Oh, and before we go past that, in Brazil, there were all these banks that had these machines called ATMs. And there was a company they had relied on to put the operating system inside of these machines. The operating system they were using was called OS2, made by a little company called, made by a little company called IBM, okay? It was still in existence. And so IBM said, sorry, we're dropping support for OS2, you're not gonna get any more bug fixes, you're not gonna get any more security hole patches, and you're not going to be able to get it for any new machines that you're going to be bringing out. So they took a look around for an alternative, and they found Linux, because Linux ran on 386s, 486s, low at Pentium, so forth, small memories. And it worked out so well that they put a little penguin on the front of every single ATM machine. It's been 10 years, and the penguin is still there. So as I said before, some of the first uses were in the military. And I kept running into all these generals and stuff who kept saying how great it was. In fact, one time I was at this trade show, and we had Alpha Linux on the system, and we were running Quake on it in emulated mode. And I was running it away, you know, it was there and everything, and nobody was really paying too much attention. And all of a sudden I just turned on the sound, and all of a sudden I had this general come running across the floor and said, "What type of system is that? What type of system is that?" I says, I know that game. Man, that's running really fast. He says, "Tell me about that." You know, the military, they don't care. And it isn't just our military. We had the Australian Army was using it for file and print services and stuff, using Samba at the time. You know, of course, the Samba was started down in Australia by Trish, yeah. Really great people down there. And then one day I'm sitting at my desk at Digital, and I get this telephone call. "Mr. Hall?" "Yes." "This is the Royal Air Force Search and Rescue." "Yes? What do you want?" "Well, we used to be using Alteryx systems to run this software back on the land, and they would radio all the information to us. We radio information back to them and stuff. But with Linux, we can actually put Linux on a laptop and take it with us in the helicopter." I says, "Okay, that's nice. Why are you calling me?" "Well, we don't know how to get the data that's on this proprietary CD-ROM Alteryx file system onto the laptop, you know, because Linux won't read the CD-ROM, and we don't know how to get it on there. Can you tell us what the format is?" I says, "Well, I can't really tell you what the format is, but why don't you just mount the CD-ROM with NFS and extract all the data that way?" "Thank you!" Next week, I got this really nice print of a helicopter from the Royal Air Force, okay? And I like to think that maybe Prince William was one of those people. Now, let's spread out a little bit. Let's start going more around the world. And let's say we've landed in India. India has two different character sets, 18 different official languages, and 5,000 unofficial languages. So how can you, as a company, support all of those languages and all of those character sets and all of that unofficial languages, and still make your system, your software, profitable? And the answer is, you can't. It's very difficult. At the same time, these people need to have the software in that particular language. And so, if it's closed source, they have no alternative. And in a lot of ways, we're all Indian. Because maybe it's not the language we need to change, but maybe it's the way the software works to suit our business. And we'll see more about that later on. There are about 140 to 150 million Swahili people. And the Swahili people wanted to have an Office package that worked in Swahili. Now, the Office package, Microsoft Office, could edit Swahili. It could manipulate Swahili. That wasn't the problem. The problem was, when it gave out an error message, the error message wasn't in Swahili. So you had to learn another language to be able to use the word processor while you're processing your Swahili. And so the Swahili people came to OpenOffice and said, "Could you?" Well, first they went to Microsoft. The Microsoft said, "I'm sorry, is just too small of a business for us. 140 to 150 million people is just too small. We're not going to do this for you. And so they went to the open office people. The open office people said, here's the source code. Go ahead and do it. And so they did. And a lot of people say, well, I don't have the expertise to change it. That's not the issue. You can find somebody who has the expertise to change it. You can make the business decision to do it. Now, this sounds like it'd just be a cut and paste, maybe, you know, or a string replication, except for one thing. In the Swahili language, there is no concept of the word download. Well, there is, but download means you have a truck sitting in front of you, and you grab a package off the back of the truck, you put it on the ground. That's download. So they had to go through and certain things like that, explain it in somewhat longer string of meaning to so that people know what was going on. Now, so far we've talked about regular uses of stuff, but I found that there was this little place in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, not far from my house, where they made robots, real-world interfaces. They merged eventually with a company called iRobot, who makes robots for military, fire defense, things like that. They actually make robots for cleaning out your gutters. That, to me, is much more interesting. And the Roombas, you've heard of the Roombas, the little robots that go around and sweep your floors and stuff like that. All those are made by iRobot. But they use Linux inside. Why? Because their customers can now add new devices, new, you know, things like that. Where iRobot actually makes their money, which is their intellectual property, is the artificially intelligent software that runs as an application on top of the operating system to guide the robot through all what it's supposed to be doing. Now, in 1997, I went to Brazil for the first time. I went to the University of Sao Paulo, and they had a Beowulf system there. Beowulf system today we call high-performance computing. It basically is taking commodity systems, putting them together, hundreds, thousands of computer systems, and decomposing your problem, making it work in parallel. This concept came up with two people, Dr. Thomas Stirling and Donald Becker of NASA, came up with this idea and started to build Beowulf systems. They use a common off-the-shelf technology, COTS, with high-speed networking between them. This gentleman right here, his name is Patrick, and he has a 16-unit Beowulf system there, which he calls Loki. And the reason he called it Loki was because he was using it to see what would happen if meteors slammed into the Earth. And up until September the 11th, 2001, he was using it at New York City. Then he moved it out to, he targeted Los Angeles instead. But in any case, that was the first time I ever saw a Beowulf system was in Brazil. And they were using it for two main things. Number one, real-time animation. Toy Story quality animation. Toy Story was rendered over a long period of time, frame by frame. But they were doing Toy Story quality in real time. They had a little platform you stood on with a baton that you would hold. And as you waved the baton, on the screen was a little opera singer. And the opera singer, if you went like this, he would start to get very loud. His chest would pop out. His voice would get strong. His eyes would bulge. He would turn to left and right as you waved your baton. But when he went like this, he got very quiet, he shrunk down a little bit. All of it was done in real time. His voice, the music, and the image, all in real time. The second use was more important. There's a program that can analyze a mammogram. On a Spark 20 computer system, it would take about 20, 24 hours to analyze a mammogram. But it's 100% accurate. It either says to the woman, you have breast cancer or you don't have breast cancer, when about 3 to 4% of the cases it says, too hard, I need the doctor to look at it. But whatever it says, it's always correct. The problem is that since it takes so long, the woman who's in the hospital in Brazil tends to go back to her village. And so if the news is bad, trying to get her to come back for new tests or to have the operation is sometimes difficult. So what happens is the hospital now FTPs the program to the university, the mammogram to the university. They run it through the Beowulf system, and 10 minutes later, they have the same answer. And they can say to the woman, congratulations, you don't have breast cancer, or I'm sorry, we need to schedule some more tests, we should do it now, or I'm really sorry, you have cancer, and we should schedule the operation now. And if that program saved even one woman's life, then it was worth it. But the third use they had was one that bothered the president of the university. He took me out to lunch, he said, we have this third use of Linux at the university. Now, Sao Paulo is the second largest city in the Western Hemisphere. It is only Mexico City is largest. New York is way down the line. And it covers huge areas. It takes about 4 hours to drive across Sao Paulo at rush hour. So the university has campuses spread out across the city. And every once in a while, one of the campuses has a Microsoft system that just refuses to boot. And they would put a system administrator in the car, send them out, they find some tiny little thing wrong, they fix it and have to drive back. So what they did was they put Linux on the other side of the disk. If the person could not boot Windows, they told them to boot Linux. If Linux worked, that meant the hardware was okay. And once Linux was up, they would FTP a brand new copy of Windows over the old one and reboot the system. And so the president was telling me this story, kind of looking at me strange. I said, yes, Mr. President, what's wrong? He says, what I want to know is this a legitimate use of Linux? I said, Mr. President, every use of Linux is a legitimate use of Linux. He was very happy with that. But if we want to take a look at the types of things that Beowulf systems can do, it's a lot of things that we really need in the world today. Image rendering, movies like The Titanic, Lord of the Rings, things like that. More and more and more realistic rendering we want. Image recognition, looking at pictures being taken by satellites. And that thing down on the surface of the ocean, it's either the conning tower of a submarine or the sail of a sailboat. Let me tell you, if you launch a missile at a sailboat, it just ruins your whole day. Weather forecasting, we were able to, many years ago, forecast with 100% accuracy the weather for the next 24 hours. But it took us 48 hours to do the processing. Now we can tell with 100% accuracy what the weather's going to be like 12 hours in the future. Which means this is why we don't keep seeing the astronauts have to come off of the space stations the way, or the rockets the way we used to in the early days of space travel as weather moved in. We can also predict with 100% accuracy whether there's going to be an earthquake in the next 30 seconds. Mad Dog, what use is that? I mean, you're an old man, you can hardly hobble to the door in 30 seconds. But the thing is that what creates a lot of the damage in an earthquake is the firestorm that happens afterwards. And so you can turn off all the gas valves, you can turn off the electricity, you can allow the earthquake to happen, and you can turn it back on in a reasonable way. So all of these things are things we knew how to do, it's just we couldn't afford to do them. And Beowulf systems gave us that ability. The interesting thing about that is that the University of Sao Paulo, year after year, went to the supercomputing conference and won awards for best price performance and best performance. And those awards are called the Gordon Bell Award. Gordon used to work for Digital. He helped to invent the VAX and BMS and stuff like that. Now he works for Microsoft in their supercomputing area. And Linux keeps winning the award that bears his name.
I love it.
One more thing about Bayer-Well systems, because they're kind of fun. This is a system that was built at Oak Ridge National Labs. They had a project they had to do, but they forgot the budget for computer time. So they went around and found a whole bunch of about, I think it was 48 cast-off computers that people had upgraded the machines at their desk. And they have your old one, sure. Take it down to a room, hook it all together with really phenomenal networking out the back. It did useful work. But this is something that you could do with the computer labs in your schools. All you need to do is run the right software on them, and you too could have a supercomputer. You could teach your students how to program a supercomputer. You could let them see the results of doing that. And then just reboot whatever other horrible operating system you want to, and you could go right back again. In 1999, I went to this place right outside of Chicago called Fermilab. They were in the process of looking for the sixth quark. They'd seen five of them already. They'd run their cyclotron for about a year, had seen only 120 quarks. When you run a machine like this, you gather huge amounts of data, and you filter through the data. You throw away 99.999% of the data, and you only store a terabyte of data a day. And since they had only seen, it wasn't 120, it was 12 quarks. They had only seen 12 quarks by running their system for an entire year. So they decided that what they were going to do is boost their cyclotron by 200 times. Generate 200 times more data. And then therefore they would see 12 times, or theoretically see 12 times 200 quarks. So they'd be able to determine what they look like, because a quark only really exists in free space for 10 to the minus 24 seconds, which is the time it takes for something traveling the speed of light to go from the center of a proton to the edge of a proton. So they had enough money to dig up their entire ring to boost its power by 200 times, but they didn't have enough money to buy the 200 times number of spark stations they needed to filter through the data. But by using inexpensive, weak, miserable, crappy Intel PCs, they could, and they did. And they found the sixth quark. So they invited us out in 1999 to speak with them. You see a very young Linus Torvalds over there in the corner giving his talk at Fermilab. And there's two big cylinders down there. Those are actually storage things for storing data, tape robots. Now, we have things of business called barriers to entry. The barrier to entry is the thing that prevents you from doing business because you can't afford something, or you don't have access to something, or you don't have the right to use something. For a long time, people were doing research, or a company in Redmond, Washington, was encouraging people to do research with their operating system, because they said, if you, as a university, do research with our operating system, when you finish your research, millions of people will be able to use it automatically, and it'll benefit lots of people. With one caveat, if we let you. And so in 1992, Digital Equipment Corporation had created a 64-bit version of Windows NT, but Microsoft wouldn't let us use it. We also created a very nice clustered file system and cluster system for Microsoft, and offered to license it to them at very, very good rates, and they turned us down. Instead, they came out with Wolfpack. Anybody remember Wolfpack? Wolfpack was the only clustered system I ever saw where two computers ran slower than one. That was less stable. Linux was 64-bit. In 1995, and the first time that Microsoft really had a 64-bit system was Vista. In 1997, I went to Helsinki, Finland, and I saw a kiosk with Linux in it. And it hit me like that. Of course, embedded systems. Why not use a free operating system in embedded systems where you do your development one time, and then you need tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies of it, royalty free. And an operating system that is secure and stable and does multitasking and has a TCP/IP stack. And it was right after that that people started using Linux more and more. Now, about this time I went back to Fiji. And the same salesperson who the first time had taken me to the university meets me and says, oh, we'd like to take you to see some customers and everything. I said, I'd like to go back to the university that I gave the CD-ROM to and see how they're doing with Linux. He goes, oh, I got bad news. They're not using Linux at all. I says, really? They seem to be so excited about it the last time. No, no. He says, they haven't said anything to me in 2 years. Nothing. Not a word. Okay. Well, can we go there anyway? Yeah. So we go there. We go to the director of the computer center, and what I notice is, as I'm talking to him, he's got a penguin on his windowsill. Something's going on. So they call in all the professors, they come into the room, the sarongs, the barefoot, and all that type of stuff. They all sit there. My salesperson is sitting on a stool next to me, and I said, how many of you are using Linux on your laptops, your servers, your desktop systems? And they all raise their hand. And he falls off of his stool. He's so surprised by this. And we get outside, he says, I don't understand it. He says, in 2 years, they didn't say a single word to me. I says, I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news is, you still may be relevant to them if you work really hard and say, how can I help you? Because the bad news is, they don't need you anymore. They've got everything they need. That was the worst day of his entire life. Then it had to work. I used to teach a small two-year technical college, and I believe that the duty of a university is not to get people jobs. The duty of a university is to teach people how to think and to educate the future leaders of a country. And I believe that free software is perfect for this, because number one, it lowers the cost to the university. And people say, well, you know, these proprietary companies give us the software. Yeah, right. But what they're hoping is that when the students leave the university, they buy the software. What they're hoping is that the companies that provide things to the university use that software. And they have to pay for it, and that means the university pays for it. There is no such thing as a free lunch. And if a student is using the software in the university and they have a co-op job, can they use that software legally at the co-op job? If the student has a part-time job outside the university, can they use that software legally on that part-time job? And the answer is no. So I think what we should be doing is teaching people about networking, not Cisco. We should be teaching people about databases, not Oracle. We should be teaching people about how to use an Office system, not Microsoft. It is perfectly okay to show people Microsoft Office as an example of an Office package. But try and do something like this with a proprietary system. Try and just say, okay, I could put a copy of the operating system on a pen drive, and you can take it with you, you can plug it into any computer you want to. This would make certain lawyers go crazy. But with free software, you can do that. And now it's more than just software. We're starting to see things like the Arduino, the Raspberry Pi, a $35 computer is powerful enough that kids can actually see it, touch it, and learn how to program it. And if you think that's good, there's one that's coming out this month from a company called Adaptiva. It has a two-core ARM9 processor on it with a gigabyte of main memory. It has a field-programmable gate array on it that you can program, digital signal processing chips, and either a 16 or 64-core CPU where each core has its own megabyte of main memory that it can program in parallel. Two USB ports, a HDMI output port. It draws less than 5 watts of power, and it costs us $99 quantity one. I call the Raspberry Pi a great system for high school students, but this is the Raspberry Pi on steroids. And what software freedom really means is the freedom to have less money leaving your country. Now again, we live in a very strange country, the United States. We have Microsoft in our country, we have Oracle in our country, and these are, you know, so the US-based companies making lots of money and employing US people. But again, the United States is a kind of a strange country because it's actually like 50 small countries. I live in the small country of New Hampshire, and we have a lot of out-of-work programmers in our country. And we make two things in New Hampshire, software and maple syrup. And I know for a fact there's only so much maple syrup that Bill Gates is going to drink. And if I have to keep sending all of my money to the small country of Redmond, Washington, then I don't have any money left over for other things. But if, on the other hand, I use free software, then I can pay some of my out-of-work programmers in New Hampshire to tailor that software to exactly what I need. And they take that money and they buy local food, local housing, and pay local taxes. And not only that, but I'm developing infrastructure in New Hampshire to attract new business in who needs skilled, trained people who knows how software works to be able to keep their company alive. If I keep sending all of that business and all of that expertise to the Redmond, Washington country, I'll never develop that skill set in New Hampshire. What about government and education? They are businesses. So a lot of times I'll talk to a large room, maybe 4,000 people in a room, and I'll ask them 4 simple questions. I'll do it here. How many of you have ever had a problem with closed source proprietary software? Yeah, I ask that in a room, and give much the same thing. One person over here doesn't raise their hand, it's because they're asleep. I ask another question. How many of you that have had the problem with closed source software have actually taken the time to hand in a well-worded problem report? Yeah. A lot of people in this room are business people, and you expect the software to work, you silly people, you. Now, I want the people that said, I turned in the problem report, I want you to raise your hands again, do this for me, raise your hands. How many of you have ever gotten back a bug fix or a well-worded workaround for that problem? A few people still have their hands raised.
Paid upgrade.
Paid upgrade. No, that doesn't count. That really doesn't count, because then you get a new set of problems, okay? And I say this in a room sometimes, and yeah, I have one person over here who raised his hand and said, Mr. Gates, you don't count. One last question. How many of you have actually had to change the way you do business to meet the way the software works instead of changing the software the way you need to change your business? And that costs you time and money. There are 2 billion desktop computers in the world today. If each one of those computers causes us problems, $5 worth of time and effort, spam, viruses, doesn't work the way we're supposed to, can't install the software, it's too complex, that means we're wasting, as a world economy, $10 billion a day. But we only do it $5 at a time. That's the problem. If we had 300 people working for us, let's say we have a call center, 300 people working for us, we waste 15 minutes a day with software that doesn't work the way it's supposed to, and we can't fix it, that's like 9 people never came into work. They didn't call in sick, they didn't out on vacation, they're not getting trained, they just didn't show up. And you, as a business person, which is not this, you'd be really mad. But if you could tune the software, fix the software, make it work the way it should, magically 2 or 3 of those people would show up. But you can't, because you don't have the source code. And so there's lots of people around the world, other countries, who have been making this decision. I remember going over to China one time and going to the post office in China, and there was a copy of Red Flag software. Looked a lot like Red Hat software at the time, but now they've changed it, and they've gone off, and they're actually doing it. And they were selling it. They were selling it in the post office for the equivalent of 70 USD. Because they said, hey, it's actually got, you know, $700 worth of functionality to it. There's a couple more projects. I know it's getting late. I want to share a couple of these with you. The one is the borehole project. The borehole in Africa is a drilling a hole into the ground. It's like a well. They get a little bit of water out of it. They drill the hole using local talent and stuff, and the way they pay for it is to collect 2 or 3 cents from each family each month to pay for this project. And the guy who was running the borehole project had about 300 or 400 families he was keeping track of. He says, I can't do any more. We can't have any more boreholes, even though they're needed, because I can't keep track of who's paid and who hasn't. If I just had a cheap computer with some software on that, if you can do this, I could handle more boreholes. Linux with GNU cache was all he needed. There were 1,600 doctors in Cuba who needed medical books, and the medical books are falling apart. You do know that we've had an embargo against Cuba for over 40 years. We only had an embargo against Vietnam for 20 years. How many people died? How many Americans died in Vietnam? 50,000. How many Americans have died in war with Cuba? But we still have this embargo against them. In any case, they needed software, but they can't get it legally because legally, Microsoft can't sell them the software. Legally, Oracle can't sell them. No U.S. company can sell any type of technology to Cuba. Even Red Hat has on their website that they cannot sell software and services to Cuba. So Cuba has decided to use free software. And they had 1,600 doctors who needed to be hooked together into a network because their medical books were falling apart. And they said, can we use Linux for this? And I said, yes. I'm probably guilty of some crime or another. So this weekend, here, we have a really great bunch of talks, a really great bunch of people. Kirk, we're going to have Mark Spencer. He's hopefully, maybe he's here by now, I don't know. But he's going to be talking about Asterisk tomorrow. We have a great group of people. Talk to them. Exchange ideas. Because we are the world. And we are part of this small community of people. So that, thank you very much. Have a nice evening. And maybe I'll actually make it back to the ball. And then